Now, as regards content, sutras are broadly of two kinds. There are Hinayana sutras and there are Mahayana sutras. The Hinayana is, of course, the first of the three major historical forms of Buddhism. Hinayana literally means little way or little vehicle. And like the Mahayana, it's more of the nature of a broad spiritual movement than a particular sect or a particular school. And the Hinayana is traditionally regarded, at least by the Mahayana, as the way or the vehicle of those who are concerned predominantly with their own individual spiritual development, not so much with that of others. The third major historical form of Buddhism, of course, is the Vajrayana, the way or vehicle of the diamond or the thunderbolt. There are only two major Vajrayana sutras. The Vajrayana tradition usually finds expression in what are known as tantras and sadhanas. Now, the Hinayana and the Mahayana sutras are very different indeed in character. The Hinayana sutras are much more what we would call of a historical nature. In them, the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, is very firmly embedded, not to say embodied, in a concrete historical context. And this concrete historical context is the context of northern India, especially northeastern India, in the 6th century BC. So we find in the Hinayana scriptures many references to the current political situation. I could give you many examples, but I think I'd better not. It would take up too much time. But many references to the current political situation. That is to say, the political situation during the Buddha's own lifetime, especially the latter part of that lifetime. Then there are references, many references, to the economic conditions of the time. Many references to various social customs. And then references to various currents of contemporary religious belief and philosophical speculation and opinion. We find all these things in the Hinayana Sutras. We even find information in the Hinayana Sutras about such things as dress, food, the sort of food that people ate, the sort of crops that they grew, the sort of houses that they built. There's information also about their various amusements, games that they played. There's a whole list in one of the texts, one of the sutras, 30 or 40 different kinds of games that people played in those days. And then references to all sorts of trades and professions and occupations. And in addition, there are references to the natural features of the country, or rather the subcontinent, India itself. There are references to descriptions of the great impenetrable forests and the majestic broad flowing rivers. There are references to the mountains, to the great mountain ranges, especially to the Himalayas and to the various seasons of the Indian year, to the hot season, the cold season, the rainy season. And there are references to the flora and fauna of the country, of the subcontinent. Descriptions of all sorts of animals and birds and trees, flowers, insects. In other words, in the Hinayana Sutras, we get a very detailed and a very vivid picture of the India that was contemporaneous with Solon and Lycurgus in Greece, Pythagoras in Italy, Zoroaster in Persia, and Confucius in China. And in this India, the Buddha taught. And he taught all sorts of people. In the Hinayana Sutras, we find the Buddha teaching wandering monks and ascetics, Brahmins, kings, princes, ministers, businessmen, farmers, philosophers, robbers, prostitutes, outcasts. We find him teaching and helping all. But in the Mahayana Sutras, we find a very different picture. The Mahayana Sutras present us with a very different picture. In many of the Mahayana Sutras, we are still in India, yes, but only just. We could also say, in the Mahayana Sutras, at least in some of the Mahayana Sutras, we're still on earth, but only just. Indeed, in a few of the Mahayana sutras, we are not on earth at all. We're in some other world, some higher world, some heavenly world, even some transcendental world. We hardly know where, and we hardly care where, because it is so beautiful and so entrancing. In the majority of the Mahayana sutras, however, the main features of the landscape, even of the Indian landscape, are still, albeit dimly, visible. We can still see houses. We can still see trees. Or at least we can see, as though through a radiant mist, a solitary mountain peak. But in the Mahayana Sutras, everything is changed. Everything has been transformed. In the Mahayana Sutras, we may say, everything has been transfigured. Everything is bathed in a sort of supernatural light. And not only that, as we go through the Mahayana Sutras, as we listen to the Mahayana Sutras, as we participate in the Mahayana Sutras, it's not just that we see everything bathed in a supernatural light. We hear also celestial music sounding, and we smell celestial perfumes. And sometimes showers of great golden blossoms fall raining down from the sky. And in some Mahayana sutras, as some of us know, the scene expands even to infinity. It expands to include not just this world, not even just this universe, but thousands upon thousands of worlds and thousands upon thousands of universes, all with their own Buddhas, all with their own bodhisattvas, all with their own presentations of the Dharma. And in the midst of it all, at the center of the Mahayana Sutra, there sits the Buddha of the Mahayana. And he sits usually in the Mahayana Sutras on an enormous, many-petaled lotus throne, supported by pairs of gigantic lions. And he sits under enormous trees, trees which are made of all kinds of glittering and resplendent jewels. And he's surrounded not just by a few beggarly looking monks, he's surrounded by a great host of beings, especially by a great host of bodhisattvas. And from the great host, and especially from the Buddha himself, there emanates in the Mahayana Sutras a great blaze of light. And it is this Buddha, seated there in the midst of that great blaze of light, who teaches the Mahayana Sutras. And while he teaches, what happens? While he teaches, all sorts of marvels occur. The earth shakes in various ways. There's a rain of flowers falling from the sky. And those listening to the exposition of the Dharma, the Mahayana Dharma, by the Buddha in the Mahayana Sutras, experience all kinds of wonderful, transcendental spiritual insights. So we find that the world of the Mahayana is a world of light, is a world of color, is a world of indescribable beauty and inexpressible joy. But at the same time, it's a very mysterious world, a very awe-inspiring world. We feel that there is in it something that we don't understand, something that is unfathomable, something that we can't understand. We feel that there's something in it, in this Mahayana world, that eludes the mind, that baffles the mind. But yet, at the same time, strangely, paradoxically, as we encounter this world of the Mahayana, we feel wonderfully happy and satisfied and serene, even peaceful, just as we contemplate that world, as we experience that world. And we may say that there's nothing quite like the Mahayana Sutras in the entire spiritual literature of the world. Not even in Buddhist literature. There's nothing quite like their atmosphere, their spirit. Sometimes they seem to read like a sort of transcendental science fiction. The nearest Western parallel, we may say, is some of the Gnostic sacred books, like the Pistis Sophia, the Faith Wisdom. These Gnostic books too are suffused with light and pervaded with a sense of mystery. Whether there's any historical connection between Mahayana Buddhism on the one hand and Gnosticism on the other, I wouldn't like to say. Dr. Konza believes that there is a connection, but the whole subject awaits thorough investigation. But certainly there is a slight but definite resemblance of spirit. And there may be a very, very faint reflection of that same spirit even later on in Western literature when we come to the Arthurian cycle, and particularly to the legend of the Holy Grail. But here we are beginning to enter the region of conjecture and surmise.